Our final case this morning, State of Ohio versus Artem Feldman. Ms. Daniel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, my name is Terry Daniel, and I represent the State of Ohio from the Office of Lake County Prosecuting Attorney, Charles Colson. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'm here today to ask this Honorable Court to do three things. First, to find that the substance of a trial court's 2943-031 advisement is more important than its form. Second, to reaffirm State versus Francis. And third, to reverse the decision of the 11th District Court of Appeals as it unnecessarily alters the standard that this court set forth in Francis. I'm asking you to hold that a bright line rule requiring an allusion to each of the three immigration-related consequences in 2943-031, namely deportation, exclusion from admission, and denial of naturalization, is inconsistent with a substantial compliance standard. In 2004, this court held that the statutorily created advisement was a non-constitutional right that was subject to a substantial compliance standard. Substantial compliance is the only workable standard based on the complexity and ever-changing nature of federal immigration law. A defendant can never be fully advised of all of the consequences he faces as a result of a plea of guilty. Thus, a verbatim recitation of the statutory advisement is not only ineffective, but potentially misleading.
But, Ms. Daniel, isn't a verbatim recitation of the statutory language precisely what the statute calls for?
Yes, Your Honor. Certainly, the statute does call for a verbatim recitation.
And even in Francis, it was described as still a better practice for the court to read the statute as it's written, which the statute calls for.
Certainly, Your Honor, but the question that we're faced with today is not necessarily what would be the better practice. The factual situation we have before us is the fact that the statute was not read verbatim. And as this court held in State versus Francis, there is a procedure specifically in place to deal with situations such as this. Specifically, this court stated that if some warning of immigration-related consequences was given, this procedure is to be followed, and substantial compliance is the standard.
If we adopt the view that you're suggesting, what's left of this statute?
Your Honor, I submit to you that substantial compliance is a standard that was recognized by this court in 2004 in Francis. And we aren't suggesting that the statute be altered because we understand that this court doesn't have the ability to rewrite the statute, obviously. And I would submit to you today that Francis is the standard that needs to be followed. And we have to get back to Francis and the definition of substantial compliance.
Well, if we need to get back to something, why don't we get back to the statute?
Because in 2004, this court held that in factual situations, such as the one this court is faced with today, where some warning of immigration-related consequences is given, substantial compliance is that standard.
So what is it that you would have us tell trial court judges to do? Or put it a different way, if one of your colleagues in this particular case is standing in the courtroom with the judge at the time, what is it that you're going to suggest to the judge be done?
Your Honor, I would suggest that the statute be read verbatim, and additionally, the next step must be taken to ensure that a defendant does have a subjective understanding of the fact that he faces potential immigration consequences, not necessarily only the three that are listed in the statute, by creating this bright-line rule, as the 11th District did in Feldman. The court makes it seem that these three statutorily listed consequences are an exhaustive list, and that's far from the case. There are many more potential immigration-related consequences that these non-citizen defendants face that are as serious, if not more serious, than those listed in the statute.
So in other words, the court should read the statute verbatim, make sure that the defendant understands that, and have some conversation about a full understanding of the potential immigration consequences before accepting a plea.
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. A trial court must ensure that a defendant has some understanding that he faces potential immigration consequences. The state is not suggesting that the trial court engaged in a detailed discussion or provide legal advice, because immigration law is very complex. It's ever-changing, and that's a burden that shouldn't be placed on the trial court. He should provide this non-citizen defendant with enough information that he can decide whether or not to go forward with entering a plea. As the United States Supreme Court discussed in Padilla, a defendant should be given enough information that he can stop entering a plea and consult an attorney who understands the intricacies of immigration law if he's concerned before entering a plea.
Counsel, was the defendant represented by an attorney at this proceeding?
Yes, Your Honor. He was represented by an attorney. In fact, at his change of plea hearing, his attorney stated on the record that his client was a non-citizen defendant and that he had discussed the potential consequences with his client, and he believed that the plea would be
knowing potential consequences based on his non-citizen standing?
Yes, Your Honor. It was specifically referenced in the transcript, and at that point, the trial court asked, immigration consequences, yes. Deportation, yes. So his message to the trial court was specific to potential immigration consequences.
And then the judge was just reiterating the deportation consequence for the benefit of the defendant?
That's correct, Your Honor. The biggest problem that Feldman creates is the fact that the standard is being shifted to one of strict compliance. As Judge Rice explained in her dissent, strict compliance does not necessarily mean a rote or verbatim recitation. It means that there is a substantial and clear disclosure of a fact or information that is demanded by the statute.
Well, isn't the test really, is this a constitutional right in order to determine whether strict compliance is what is necessary here?
Yes, Your Honor, that's absolutely correct. This court in Francis specifically found that, like the nature of the charges against a defendant or the potential consequences that they face upon entering a plea, that this statutorily created right was a non-constitutional right, and that's why it is subject to a substantial compliance standard.
Wasn't that decision made before Padilla? And hasn't Padilla perhaps changed the analysis on whether there's constitutional rights at stake here?
I think that perhaps the standard has changed post-Padilla, but I would submit, Your Honor, that it has changed not necessarily in the way you may view it. In Padilla, first, I'd like to preface my comments by explaining, in the federal system, an advisement of this nature is not required or even provided to defendants in the criminal system. They are presumed to be aware of these consequences upon entering a plea. So the fact that this case places the burden of informing the non-citizen defendant on trial counsel is different than the system we have here in Ohio, where there is a statutorily created right. But I think the major point that we can take out of Padilla is the fact that these changes are not just necessarily nomenclature. We're talking about substantive changes that occur on a relatively frequent basis in a very, very complex law. So placing a burden on a trial court, a state trial court, that's not familiar with the intricacies of federal immigration law is not the burden that we should be putting on them. The trial court should be required to determine whether that non-citizen defendant understands that there are consequences that he may face. And at that point, he's given the option of whether he would like to proceed and enter a plea or consult with an immigration attorney. Did that answer your question, Your Honor? Your Honor, seeing that my time is running narrow, I'd like to reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Cartwright-Jones.
May it please the Court. Mr. Chief Justice. At counsel table is Attorney Tanya Linetsky and Attorney Scott Bratton for Amicus. I'd like to yield 7.5 minutes or whatever I have remaining to Attorney Bratton. The ultimate issue here is what, under this Court's 2004 decision in State versus Francis, is substantial compliance. State versus Francis left open the issue of how much of a recitation of the script or essential elements of Revised Code Section 2943.031 a trial bench would have to get through in order to affect substantial compliance. State v. Francis remanded that case for a hearing under the subjective understanding test to determine whether indeed Mr. Francis understood the immigration-related consequences of his plea. As a historical note, the case was remanded, the trial court vacated it, and the case was eventually worked out. We're offering to this court, in our proposition of law, that substantial compliance means reciting the meat and potatoes, the basic three elements of Revised Code Section 2943.031.
Since this is not a constitutional right, and we've already determined that, and in fact, if the counsel's correct, this is not even given in federal court, do we look at the prejudice issue? Because now you have, what, is this 11 years later?
This is 11 years later. We
and
do.
You have witnesses that disappear, the evidence that isn't there anymore. So how do we have, because we don't have a constitutional right, do we have a prejudice issue to look at and a finality issue?
Let me break this down into, I think there are three questions that Your Honor asks, actually. Let me address the issue of prejudice and finality first. No, the statute does not indicate that there is a prejudice analysis. It's a subjective understanding test, at least as far as this court gave us in State versus Francis, although timing comes into play. I would highlight a portion of State v. Francis relative to timing and prejudice, however, because a crucial element of that statute that is not addressed in State v. Francis is that the petitioner, Mr. Feldman in this case, is required to demonstrate upon the time he presents his motion for vacature that he would be subject, because of that plea, to an immigration-related consequence. In this particular case, literally days after Mr. Feldman was detained for re-entering the United States, we, of course, filed a petition saying, hey, wait a minute, he was never, ever, ever informed of the possibility that he could be denied admission to the U.S., that being one of the three 2945.031 elements. He was never informed that he could be subject to exclusion from admission. This is further exacerbated by the fact that, of record and on affidavit, Mr. Feldman exited and entered the United States multiple times without issue. He was informed that he couldn't be deported. He was never deported. Obviously, that would create the picture in his mind that, well, 10 years later, I don't have any immigration consequences.
So under your theory of the reading of the statute, if 20 years had passed and he, for the first time, had tried to leave and then could not get back in, he could immediately file his petition and there is no timeliness issue.
Under the plain text of the statute, absolutely, though, that could be addressed by the government in terms of estoppel arguments. If the government could show, oh, wait a minute, you had notice, you'd spoken with attorneys subsequent to that. At issue in this case, the government presented no documentary evidence by way of affidavits or anything else to rebut the point.
You haven't answered my question.
Again, Your Honor?
The question is, under your theory of the statute, there is no problem in 20 years later this happening, and the defendant being able to contest the plea.
Under the plain text of the statute, there would not be a problem with a motion to vacate 20 years after. No. It could be addressed if there was some showing of collusion or of undue delay or of something like that under this court's decision in State versus Francis. But just with the number 20 years, that would not be dispositive. And indeed, this court in 2004 in State v. Francis said timeliness can come into play, but timeliness itself is not dispositive. Now, I had mentioned in answering that prior question on prejudice that there was another part I wanted to get to, that being constitutionality. In the last part of our brief, we addressed the government's argument that Padilla basically stands for the proposition that one only need be informed that he could be deported. We respond to that by saying if Padilla does anything germane to Mr. Feldman's case, it pushes those elements of Revised Code Section 2943.031 closer to the constitutional realm. That was the U.S. Supreme Court that took that case on a certified petition on an issue of constitutional law relative to voluntariness, knowingness, and intelligence of waiving one's Fourth and Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights through a guilty plea. So by all means, the court stopped short of saying these are now constitutional rights. Obviously, they're not. They're not enumerated in the Constitution. But from 2004 to the present, I don't think there's any doubt that the Padilla decision now pushes those elements closer to the constitutional realm, and that because of that decision, they get closer scrutiny than they did before Padilla.
Mr. Cartwright-Jones, as a practical matter, in the application of taking pleas, we know that judges have a tremendous responsibility to make sure that defendants understand the consequences of the plea. And what we're talking about here is a type of consequence for a particular defendant who is not a citizen of the United States. Are you saying that the colloquy here that the judge had with someone who was represented by an attorney was not sufficient substantial compliance?
Absolutely not. And here's why. We only have one of the potential elements. Now, the state...
Well, the judge specifically asked questions and got the information that this individual had an attorney, was advised by an attorney, had talked about the immigration status, and was clear on that. You're saying that was not sufficient for substantial compliance?
Absolutely not. There are three elements that statute addresses. We're not saying that they have to read the entire script. Let's begin. Revised Code Section 2943.031 contains a script and asks for a verbatim recitation. There are three key elements.
So if the judge had just in a monotone recited that language,
yeah,
would be enough.
If the judge had said, either in a monotone recited the script, or had said, Mr. Feldman, do you understand that this plea could subject you to denial of naturalization, deportation, or exclusion from admission to the United States? Now, the important thing about that statute is it goes on to ask a court if the defendant says, I don't understand this, to give him the opportunity to consult with counsel or immigration counsel and indeed continue the hearing. That also was never addressed. The court just says this could subject you to some immigration consequences, including deportation. That is a one-third reading of the statute, which the Eighth District and a number of sister reviewing courts have wholeheartedly rejected. And I'd continue. What happens when we allow a court to just go through one-third of the Criminal Rule 11 colloquy and say, well, that's good enough? It's an incredibly slippery slope when we say, well, you don't really have to inform a defendant of everything that the revised code of the U.S. Constitution requires. You know, he had an attorney standing next to him who may or may not have been familiar with the intricacies of immigration law or constitutional law.
So instead of having a colloquy, we should just have the judge reciting verbatim all of this language without really finding out if the defendant is understanding what this language really means, well, and whether the person has consulted with an attorney and understands the consequences.
According to the plain text of the statute, yes. And if he doesn't, the burden then shifts, according to the statute, to that defendant to say, I don't understand, I want a continuance to speak with counsel.
In reading your statement of the facts, you talk about the case proceeding through arraignment and pretrial, and at the time, Artem spoke little English. How would that have impacted had the judge said, you know, you're subject to removability or, any of the other terms that could have been used in place of deportation or reentry refusal or denial of your naturalization efforts?
If there was a language issue, it was the defendant's responsibility, and is the defendant's responsibility through counsel to ask for an interpreter.
Well, it's your statement of facts, and I'm reading it. At the time, Artem spoke little English.
We're not principling the case on the fact that Mr. Feldman spoke little English. We're principling the case on the fact that the trial court didn't inform him of the essential elements of the statute.
Even though he couldn't understand them because he spoke little English.
Well, we didn't say he couldn't understand English at all, but yes, as a matter of fact that we offered on affidavit, his English was diminished. Now, I think diminished English is going to be, you know, an issue with any immigrant who pleads without an interpreter. But we would concede that it's the responsibility of the applicant to ask for an interpreter outright. It makes it a slightly more sympathetic case, but that issue we wouldn't offer to the court would be dispositive. I have 5 minutes left. I'd like to cede time to amicus counsel if there are no further questions from the bench.
Very good.
Thank you.
Bratton.
May it please the court, I'm Scott Bratton on behalf of amicus Margaret Wong and Associates. I just wanted to emphasize a couple of points that have been addressed here today. The statute's clear as to what is required when a trial court accepts a guilty or no contest plea from a non-citizen. There's three consequences. Those consequences are in quotation marks. We're not arguing that there has to be substantial compliance with the statute. The 11th District's decision isn't a substantial compliance standard, a strict compliance standard. We're arguing that substantial compliance is the proper legal standard in this particular case, and that by stating one of the three, that doesn't constitute substantial compliance. The defendant can't possibly subjectively understand the implications of his guilty or no contest plea if he's not advised of two of the three possible immigration consequences. And as I set forth in our brief at length, those consequences are different, and certain criminal cases can trigger one, two, or three of the consequences.
Well, Mr. Bratton, I don't want to get into a full-blown education about immigration law, but I know in your brief you talk about Mr. Feldman was subject to exclusion, but he was not subject to deportation. Can you briefly explain how those work differently?
There's different grounds for deportation and admissibility to the United States. If someone is in the United States and they commit a crime, they would be and they've been legally admitted to the United States, they would be subject to the grounds of removability set forth in INA 237. If someone's an applicant for admission to the United States, the law is different. It's set forth in Immigration and Nationality Act Section 212. And I'll give you an example. A domestic violence conviction in the state of Ohio, a misdemeanor domestic violence conviction, would subject someone to removal from the United States. However, it wouldn't make someone inadmissible to the United States because of the way that the law is written. On the opposite end, if someone is convicted of a felony for theft or the conviction in this case, and they've been in the United States for more than 5 years, although it may be a crime involving moral turpitude, they're not subject to removal on that ground. However, the Section 212 analysis is different because that would fall outside the petty theft exception, and one crime involving moral turpitude, no matter when it's committed, would cause someone to be inadmissible to the United States. So there's distinct tests for whether a crime render someone subject to removal, whether someone would be inadmissible to the United States, and whether someone would be denied naturalization. And I tried to set those forth in the brief because it's very important. The clients should be concerned about each of these. I mean, an example that I have is I had a client who entered a guilty plea. His attorney told him this isn't going to subject you to deportation. The judge only stated deportation, and they were correct. My client couldn't be deported. He could stay in the United States forever and couldn't be deported and could have applied for naturalization. Nobody went on to tell him you could be denied admission to the United States or excluded from admission to the United States. And when he left the United States to visit his sick parents and came back, he was denied admission to the United States and held in immigration custody for 9 months until we could get his case resolved.
So, Mr. Bratton, your position is that substantial compliance requires at least notice of three aspects of the statute involved.
Correct, yes.
What about the timeliness issue? As Justice Stratton raised earlier, raising this question 11 years later, do we require the state to maintain witness lists and active addresses on all victims of crimes and evidence ad infinitum? How do we do this?
Well, Your Honor, the timeliness issue was addressed in Francis, and the court in Francis says that, you know, it's a factor that can be considered. So if there's a prejudice factor, that's something that can be raised. They also look at when the defendant actually
learned. Should we look at prejudice in this case?
Well, I believe so, yes. The defendant in this particular case was not aware that if he left the United States, he wouldn't be able to return. And as soon as he found that out, within a short period of time, he filed a motion with the trial court to withdraw his guilty plea. So I do believe that in this case that motion itself was timely, and I think that that's follows along
with
no the test
limit
in Francis.
On it. The question came up earlier, 20 years is just a fine time. If it happens 20 years later, you can vacate it after 20 years.
Well, this court in Francis specifically addressed that and stated that there's no limit, but stated that you have to look at a number of different things in making that determination and decide whether, you know, timeliness should be a ground to deny a motion to withdraw a guilty plea. So that was addressed in Francis. I don't think that that's an issue in the case based on the fact that he did file within a short time of the finding out of the immigration consequences. And I don't believe the state's argued much in the way of prejudice at this point in time.
So your singular position then is that we should apply a substantial compliance standard in connection with this statute with respect to the three areas covered by the statute or the advice given by the court?
Correct, Your Honor. I believe that substantial compliance with the statute would mean that they have to at least, that the trial judge has to at least touch on each of the three distinct elements that are set forth in the statute. And these are distinct elements that need to be touched upon so that the non-citizen defendant can have an understanding of what the consequences would be if he enters into this plea.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bratton. Ms. Daniel?
Thank you, Your Honor. It's important to remember that this isn't a numbers game. And I'd like to give you two examples to indicate why the rule in Feldman cannot apply in these situations. First, picture a situation where a non-citizen defendant comes to court. He has an immigration attorney with him, well-versed in the intricacies of immigration law. The counsel states on the record, "I have discussed each and every one of these three consequences with my client." He lists them by name. Now, in that case, if the trial court fails to list each and every one of the three immigration-related consequences in this statute, that defendant's plea would be involuntary and unknowing. Now picture a situation where a non-citizen defendant comes to court. He doesn't have a firm grasp of the intricacies of immigration law. He cannot afford an immigration attorney. He receives the advisement verbatim, but he may or may not have any understanding of what those words actually mean to him. And this defendant, we would presume under Feldman, would have entered a knowing and voluntary plea. Words alone, these three statutory consequences, terms of art, are not providing these defendants with a true understanding of the potential immigration consequences that he faces. Feldman is a good example. He has been held under mandatory civil detention since removal proceedings began against him. This is a mandatory civil detention that was imposed by the United States Congress as part of the statute. He wasn't advised that he may spend an indefinite amount of time locked up in Seneca County as a result of entering a plea in this case. We can never advise these defendants of each and every one of the possible immigration consequences because they are so complex and because there are so many different factors that go into whether or not a defendant may be removable.
Ms. Daniel, and I hear what you say, and it sounds to me that you're talking about the importance of the defendant truly understanding the consequences. Apply that analysis, if I understand what you've said correctly, to what was said to Mr. Feldman in the trial court in this particular case. How does how does this case meet that standard of his understanding those consequences?
Yes, Your Honor. This case is a great example of how he's met those consequences. At the time, his attorney stated on the record that he had had discussions with his client about the potential consequences that he faced. There is no indication in the record that counsel was at all ineffective, or that there's no evidence in the record at all that would indicate this defendant would not have entered a plea had he received the full advisement. And that's exactly what the trial court found in this case. And I would refer you to the trial court's decision on the petition for 2943-031, because it is very detailed. And as this court held in Francis, that determination is within a trial court's sound discretion. Now, in this case, the factual findings of the trial court were not considered by the 11th District. Instead, they created this bright-line rule. I did want to get back to Justice O'Connor's question about whether the defendant spoke little English. And I did just, for the record, wanted to indicate that that is nowhere supported by the record. And even if it was supported by the record, reviewing courts cannot substitute their personal feelings about immigration or their sympathy for any given defendant for the informed judgment of the United States Congress. Congress created these statutes for a reason. They're very specific. There are very many factors that are considered. And this is the purpose of the immigration courts. There are many different layers. They look at many aspects of these individuals before there is a determination that's made in regards to whether or not they'll be removed, whether or not they will face another penalty that's not listed by the statute. So this is the proper venue for this determination is in the immigration courts. It's not at the state trial court level.
Ms. Daniel, isn't the proper place for this to be sorted out in terms of what a trial court judge, the policy established by the General Assembly in writing the statute that used a particular phrase, instructing trial court judge to speak this to the defendant and make sure the defendant understands? Isn't that the proper form?
Your Honor, I see my time is up. May I briefly respond?
Sure.
Your Honor, the General Assembly, if I understand your question correctly, the Ohio General Assembly would be the best place to alter the advisement that's being given to non-citizen defendants right now. And I understand that, again, this is not the duty of this court to rewrite statutes that come from the General Assembly. However, this court did take it upon itself in 2004 to find that this statutorily created advisement is a non-constitutional right subject to a substantial compliance standard. And it is well within this court's province to determine how strictly trial courts comply with statutes that are created by the General Assembly.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude? The state requests that this honorable court reverse the decision of the 11th District Court of Appeals in State versus Feldman and hold that substantial compliance with 2943-031 does not mandate a reference to each and every one of the statutorily listed consequences in 2943-031. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Ms. Daniel. Mr. Marshall, you may close court.
All right.